Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
You got to step out there right on the line, and that is where you can create change.
Award-winning environmentalist and author Diane Wilson joins us to talk about her latest book, Diary of an Eco Outlaw, An Unreasonable Woman Breaks the Law for Mother Earth. It's a sequel to her first book, An Unreasonable Woman. She was a 24-year-old boat captain taking in shrimp before turning into an environmentalist, and the story of how that happened is both uplifting and at times shocking, as Diane Wilson takes on Dow, Union Carbide, and Formosa Plastics, trying to get these and other companies to stop polluting. She's been jailed 50 times for civil disobedience and has taken on people like Union Carbide CEO Warren Anderson, former Vice President Dick Cheney, and former BP CEO Tony Hayward. Diary of an Eco Outlaw is sure to be another major success by Diane Wilson. Diane Wilson, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm real glad to be here.
Well, I do want to say, first of all, that I really enjoyed your book. And, you know, in part because the way you write is so open, and your experiences while taking on big industrial polluters are amazing. And to read about them in this personal and up-close way is really very interesting.
I appreciate the comments about the book because I like writing, so I'm always glad to hear somebody likes the way I communicate. Thank you.
Now, on page 59 of Diary of an Eco Outlaw, you're explaining about what it was like to prepare to climb on top of a Dow oxide tower. And you're waiting and worrying that, you know, maybe this is the hardest part of your action, you know, where you're wondering what could go wrong. And then once you have your banner up there, you're on the phone to media, and all at once it comes home to you that this is the media that has to notice and care. And you write, you know, can you hear me? Just take it from there, because I thought that was a wonderful way of describing the kinds of things you do.
The action to climb the tower was very spontaneous, and I had did it right immediately off of a 30-day hunger strike. And, you know, you would think that when it's after 9/11 and you've got a big chemical plant and you've had a woman out in front of your plant for 30 days, you might be a little careful about the woman and where she is. And it's amazing how many things you worry about and think are going to stop you doesn't at all. So it took me one day to decide to do it, one day to get my camouflage. And like I said, I had a Union Carbide worker put me in the back of his truck and haul me straight into it. He didn't realize I was a activist in disguise. And I know when I went up on that chemical tower, I had been up there. I went up there right before daybreak. I went up at dark, and I was amazed how little people look up. They never look at their tires. I guess they don't expect any people to be lurking up there. But I was up there for a couple hours before I finally had to stand up. And when I finally called the media from Houston, and I think that was the one thing I hadn't betted on. I didn't realize how loud it was up there, because it was this oxide tower, and it was just this hissing. And I was screaming over this cell phone. It was the first time I'd ever had a cell phone, and because it was just to let the media know, because otherwise nobody was going to know. You know, I was in this little Orange County down there, and very isolated, very rural. You know, we got a lot of pollution, but there isn't a lot of publicity down there. So that Houston reporter and actually a radio guy came all the way to Seadrift, and it was him standing out there with his camera taking pictures that actually drew the security, because he couldn't figure out what that guy was taking pictures of his plant for. And that's when they finally, after I stood up and waved at the security guy, that's when they finally realized I was up in their tires.
And your banner actually said at the time, Dow responsible for Bhopal.
That's right.
You know, the deadly disaster in India. And that was your early decision to take that company on in Texas. And then now there have been many other decisions of a similar nature. And I'd just like you to tell us, first of all, though, Why was the Bhopal devastation hitting you so hard? I mean, let's start again at the beginning and just talk about why that compelled you into all these other challenges that would result even in your challenging in person people like Tony Hayward.
Well, a little bit is the fact that I live in a little rural place. The people are not highly educated. We're country people down here. We live surrounded by these chemical plants, and you know so very little about them. And I know the Union Carbide plant right outside Seadrift, it had been there almost since the day I was born. It had been there since the early 1950s. And it had very little written about it. And I remember in 1991, it had just been voted the safest plant in Texas by the Texas Chemical Council, which is a conglomeration of associations of all the chemical plants in Texas. And they awarded it to Union Carbide. And about 2 weeks later, the whole thing blew sky high. And, I mean, it sent shrapnel the size of a Cadillac clear across in the marshes. I remember from where I stood in my house out in the country, it shook the house, and I saw the explosions through the window. And they say it was extremely lucky it happened at 2 in the morning because it was only a skeleton crew there. So there were 180 workers injured, and a man was killed, a worker was killed. And I'm so isolated, I really had no sense of the bigger global environment out there. You know, I can remember when I was a little girl and I'd be down at the fish house heading shrimp, and I could see cars coming to town, I guess, to buy shrimp every once in a while. I was so in my little world of Seadrift, is I couldn't figure out where those cars were coming from, because I thought my existence ended outside of Seadrift city limits. So to suddenly, one day after Union Carbide blew up, to have a man walk into my yard and ask me to go to India. And I hesitated about 30 seconds. And, you know, and I'm just kind of, that's the way I work. That's the way you shrimp when you're around the bays all your life. It's extremely intuitive, and you just, you move from your gut. And I did, and I went to India, and what I saw over there, you know, I know a lot of people, they go over and it's just a cultural shock, but for me it was more than that, because one, I felt so connected with the people. In many ways they were just like my small little town of Seadrift. I mean, your lives, the jobs you do, your communities is as valuable as it is over here in Texas. I mean, we're expendable, you know, when there's accidents, when there's contamination in the bays. It's very similar to what happened over to India, except it was so much worse. And it happened in 1984. It was an experimental pesticide plant. And naturally, Union Carbide was not making money, so they just start taking away, you know, your expenses, your safety, your refrigeration, your alarms. And then the unbelievable happens, you know, the things they say, oh, it will never happen, it happened. And that first two nights, they estimate anywhere maybe 8,000, maybe 13,000 people died in 2 days. It's unbelievable. It was like little babies, children, old grandmas, the dogs, the cows. They said there were so many bodies in the river that there was a log jam at the bridges, and there were so many shrouds covering the bodies, it looked like snow. It looked like it had snowed. And when I went there, and it was 91, so it wasn't quite, it was about 8 years later, and it was like it had still happened. The facility was still there. The contamination was still there. The boxes and stacks and the processes and the, you know, all of the material they have, it was still sitting there. And the people, there were still 30 dying a month from that incident. They were a forgotten people. It was a race against forgetting. And we are, you know, especially this country, we are so notorious for forgetting as fast as we possibly can. We've got this amnesia. We can, you know, it's like the BP thing. Let's forget it as soon as we can. And over in India, they had such few advocates to help the world remember. And I remember I was given testimony. I was the only American there, and it was a tribunal. It was kind of similar to the Nuremberg trials, and it was where all these people were given testimony about the environmental damage. And I was the only one from America, and I remember they had a busload of us, and they were taking us to this huge coliseum where we testified and had all these interpreters. And I remember one time I was on the bus, and this man, he was this little tiny Indian man. He had these white shirt and white shorts, and he chased the bus down, and he threw this handkerchief through the window, and it kind of bopped me straight in the head, and it fell in my lap. And I couldn't figure out what it was. So I opened it up. It was about 10 photographs, black and white photographs, and they were photograph after photograph of tiny infants. They were like newborns, and I couldn't figure out why these babies, one, were so little infants, and that why they were all on white sheets, every one of them, and there looked like there was blood smear across the sheets, and I couldn't figure it out, and I passed it on to some of the people on the bus, and they would not even look at it. And so finally this guy said, he said the women, when they were running, the ones that were pregnant, they had spontaneous abortions, and those were the babies. And it was pitiful.
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it? I mean, starting with this pain, but, you know, you said earlier that you and some of your fellows, where you come from as a shrimper, were not educated, and I would say differently educated, right?
Oh, yeah, very differently educated.
And then later in your book, about page 150, where you're talking with someone named Ronnie about Formosa.
Oh, yeah.
And you're told, you know, that kid's book, It Takes a Village. Well, Formosa ought to write one called It Takes an Explosion.
That's right, because that is the only way there is any change. You know, you're around all of these dangerous chemicals. They're constant exposures. There's flash fires. There's things that are very volatile, and a lot of workers get burned. And the thing that is none of the workers had a flame-retardant uniforms, and it's not that they don't know about it. There is all types of information about safety and what the worker needs, but it's like one of the main problems with Formosa, and it's been a reputation they've had since they've been there, is just the simple cheapness, because they don't want to spend money for safety because it takes away from the profit. And the irony of it is, but yet when it comes time that they have to start looking good to the press and all that, and suddenly they start giving the sheriff's department police cars, or they start giving them computer systems, or they start giving the ambulance defibrillators or all this stuff. And it's like, it's amazing what they will chinch on, and then what they will turn around and pass off as, you know, things under the table, you know, like, because I was a fisherman, they tried to get the fisherman. And so what they did is they got my cousin, who probably only had a 10th grade education, and they paid him $65,000, and all he had to do was kind of follow me around and tell Formosa what I was doing. And sometimes he said he went into the office and he just cut out newspaper articles for him. $65,000. Do you know how many of those little mini-ray 2000s that really can measure releases, vinyl chloride releases, or how many uniforms it could buy for the workers, or, you know, the mask or any of that they could have spent on that? But no, I was always amazed at their priorities, and it was always just to keep the plant running at maximum.
Well, we see this now, of course, in the window of opportunity that exists, according to many environmentalists, after Fukushima's nightmare, that people are rethinking some of these aging plants and safety. But, you know, we're not that far away from watching the Gulf of Mexico oil spill caused by the same kind of processes, it sounds like.
That is right. You know, I was actually horrified at the amount of change that has happened since the BP oil spill. I know after the Exxon Valdez, there was somewhat of a change. But I guarantee you, on the BP spill, it's like they have already started giving these deep water permits. They haven't did anything for the workers. They haven't did anything for the safety. They've kind of changed the name of the organization, but the same people are running the whole thing. And it's like, I do not see any change, you know. And I have had people, they say, well, you know, it just takes, maybe it takes a lot of bodies for people to finally force government to change, or for the government to finally start seeing how we're going to have to change everything we do. And it's like, I don't see it, quite frankly. I do not see it. So I know when I went to Washington that time, I went there because I was so angry. I was so angry, and a lot of my actions, I had no idea, you know, what I was going to accomplish. I really didn't. It was just the outrageousness of what had been going on. And then for all those agencies to suddenly pretend that they were so concerned about the environmental law and the workers and all that, because trust me, they are not concerned about the workers. They couldn't care less about the workers. It's all about profit. It's all about power. This is a corporate country, and it's just keep the thing running. They want to keep the machine running, and they grind up the people and the community and the environment with it.
Diane Wilson, I understand you've actually been recently taking on big oil. Why don't you talk about your latest efforts? Because I know that even as you're talking about feelings of, you know, in some ways, futility, you're still going, you're still at it, and you're still effective, in my opinion.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. You know, I'm a different type of activist. You know, a lot of activists, they have groups, and they have these really lengthy alliances, and they make these deep plans, and there's a lot of lobbying, and I just kind of do grassroots civil disobedience. And I guess what I do is I use the opportunity of spontaneous moments and serendipity, I guess because I've been on the base so long, and I believe in the connectedness of everything, that I think in a funny little way, and I know it starts making some activists real nervous when I start talking this way, but I really do. I believe you can get an alliance with the universe, and it's like it wants to help, and it's like use the energy. And so I end up doing these really kind of outrageous actions. Sometimes it's got very little planning with it. I just move it. There's a quote I always love saying is, boldness has magic. Che Guevara said that, and I believe that. And so the action I did against BP when I went to Washington, that was pure spontaneity, and it was to get right in their faces. I believe you have to get in their faces. I believe people can make a difference, and a lot of times I don't know how you're going to make the difference, and I don't know the circumstances of it or how it's going to work. You know, it's not at all like a group going to Washington and lobbying, where they have got this clearly directed goal and their objective and how they were going to do it. I just kind of go by the seat of my pants and my passion, and I get up as close as I can and just watch it happen. And it generally does. It happens.
It sure does. Whether you're talking about a stockholders meeting or, you know, a plant or workers or whatever it may be, it certainly does happen for you, Diane Wilson. And I want to trace the roots of some of this activity, really, to something that you were saying back on page 6. And you write, quote, "They looked slow, all right, but they were quick, quick on the bay. They could calculate ice and fuel costs and the amount of fish and shrimp caught in a 16-hour day to the exact pound. They could remember where the fish went, how the reefs ran, where the rosette spoonbills, the pink birds, flew up from the marsh in waves of pink clouds, and where every dang wreck in the bay was. But their cantankerous beliefs about women were set in the 16th century or thereabouts, and they weren't in any mood to learn different. So they rousted out all things female on the bay as if we were plague-carrying rats."
Oh, that's true. That's true. They always treat women as if they were bad luck. If a woman came on board, the men just immediately started talking about, oh, we're going to have bad luck today, and especially if they turned over a hatch cover. And in many ways, I guess people whose lives and their fortune depend very much on the whims of nature and the wind. And, you know, and like some of them, they used to, you know, like whistle up the wind. And I know some men, they would like nail coins to their mast poles. There was a lot of superstition and rituals that you did. And it was, women were notorious for being the bringers of bad luck. And so I know when I started saying I was going out, you know, well, one, they got a zillion different reasons why a woman is not any good out there on the bay. And predominantly, the reason why there aren't women out there is because the men, the daddies, never take their daughters out there. And a woman can get intimidated by a net. If she's not around a net, you can get intimidated. In the winches, you know, that to pull up the ropes, if you don't mess with them, you get intimidated. You know, you see all those gears and they're moving and you've got, you know, ropes coming around them and chains. If you don't deal with that, it can be very scary. So a lot of women just back away from it. But I loved it probably because I was such a quiet person. I loved the solitariness. And also I had a vision when I was very young and I saw the water. I literally saw the water and it was a woman and she was an old woman. And I remember her personality and I remember how she looked. And so I loved going to the bay just because this old woman was there. And that old woman loved for me to come to the bay. And so when you have that feeling, it's like it just draws you. That's where I felt at home. And so the fisherman, one, I guess because I was with my dad shrimping so much, and the other is because I was a dang good net person. And those men could not figure out how I knew how to do that. They would just look at me like they could not believe I knew how to do it. I could fix their torn up nets. I could hang their nets. And they were very superstitious about their nets had to be hung exactly right. And I could build shrimp nets. I could put on turtle extruders. I could do the whole bit. And generally, all they want to do is make sure that I got plenty of coffee and I didn't get mad and I did their nets for them. So they didn't say too many things to me to get me upset.
It's almost like they say, you know, if you learn to do one thing well, you can apply it later on to other things.
It's very true, very true.
You know, you write about another part of your activism. You really became a journalist and documented what you were living through and what you were learning. And so you write that I had a little black notebook that by now held so much of the Formosa story within its white pages that it throbbed metal and pipe like Scarecrow's heart trying to stay alive.
Yeah, that was true. I kept because it was so many stories because it was almost like the secret discharges and the illegal activity. A lot of it was to document all of that, but then I must think in pictures because all I could do is I could look at an entry where I talked about this specific worker and what he said and I could see it already in my head. It was like a video playing straight in my head. And it was a wonderful, when I first started writing my first book, I'd see those notes and it was just immediate. It's almost like writing what you see in your head, and I seem to have a knack. All the fishermen down here, they say, like when I quote a shrimper or my brother talking or a woman at the fish house talking, they say, "Boy, you got her down good." So I must have a knack for catching the way they talk. I like the dialogue.
And you also are very practical. And I want to say, Diane Wilson, that to anyone listening who has aspirations of being an activist on any level, this is the book to read, Diary of an Echo Outlaw. And you also mention on page 69 of this book that it's not hard doing a hunger strike in a holding cell because you're rarely given food anyhow.
That's very true. That's very true. You know, that old axiom about if they give you a lemon, make lemonade, that is so true. It's like there is never a place where you can't turn it into an act of civil disobedience. And I remember I read somewhere about one of the Beringen brothers, the priest, and one of them was stuck in prison, actually. I think he was kind of sick, so they put him in the medical unit. And he got the entire medical unit where he was to go on a strike. And the prison got so mad at him, they threw him out of jail. And I'm like, now that's the way to just take the situation you're in and just turn it on its ear. You know, and actually doing a hunger strike is a pretty good thing you should try in jails. Is one, it really, really is upsetting to them. And two, it's got a lot of historical, a lot of great people have went to jails and did hunger strikes. You know, that's where the suffragettes, that's where some of the our best movements have happened in the jails. And I remember one time I was in jail and I had a visitor and I was really surprised. In come the Green Party, the Green Party of Texas, and they wanted me to run for election. I think Texas Railroad Commission or something or another. And I'm like, well, I'm in jail. And they're like, yes, we know. We think it's terrific. We you would do great running for a Texas office in the county jail. So it's a real creative place to come up with ideas.
It says a lot about you that you paid attention to the fact that health care was withheld as punishment in cases that you document.
That is so right. You would be amazed at the amount of deaths just because of withholding medical care. They already have prescriptions for it. Oftentimes it's already sitting in the jails and their belongings, but it's just, I don't know, orneriness, meanness. It's just, it seems to be one place where it's okay to just be mean. And I am still horrified about the justice system in this United States and how we treat people. And it's like there were more people who died in Harris County Jail than was killed, that died in Abu Ghraib in Iraq. I guarantee you, there is a lot of strange stuff that goes on.
What do you see as the most important thing for people, if they can do just one thing, you know, what that might be?
I think most people are under the illusion, and actually Gandhi said it better than I did. He said people are under the illusion that you have to have money, you got to have people, you got to have an organization to make change. And he said that's a fallacy. It's like all you need is commitment and like an intention. And the thing is people get commitment really screwed up. Because most of the things we do, it's half-hearted, where we don't want to mess up the normalcy of our lives. We don't want to have to go to jail. We don't want to have to do it during the week where we might miss work or that someone might see us or we don't want to give too much money. We don't want to put our job at risk, our name at risk, anything at risk. So we do things half-heartedly, and then we get totally surprised. You know, I can't believe I've seen people that do something a couple of weekends and they are really hacked off that there hasn't been change in the times they went out there. And it's like, well, you're giving it just half your heart. It's like we have to realize that, as one of the Berrigan brothers says, is the reason there is no peace or the reason there is no clean earth and planet is because we are not peacemakers and we are not environmentalists because we don't give it the full heart. We go very weakly, very mildly, and we want to stay nice and we want to stay normal and not too much disruption. And we have to realize you got to step out there right on the line, and that is where you can create change.
It has been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Dori.
Diane Wilson's new book is Diary of an Echo Outlaw, and we'll link to further information about the book at our website, talknationradio.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.